It's a joy to be with you tonight. I see some folks are added. Sorry about the technical issues tonight, guys. And I'm just going to jump in. Before I do, I'm going to just pray for our time. Lord, we're grateful for this opportunity to reflect on the gospel and how it is powerful to save. And you use us to, in all of our fallenness and brokenness, to tell other beggars where the food is. And so we pray you would use that. You would use us in our friends and our neighbors and our coworkers' lives. Lord, will you put people on our mind tonight that we need to reach out to and we need to strike up a conversation with? We pray all this in Christ's name. Amen. Just a couple things real quick. Week 3 recording is being kind of, we had some issues with that. It will be posted tomorrow, and then this recording will be posted in the next 2 or 3 days. So if you're looking for week 3 and you were hoping to watch that, we're sorry about that. You should find it tomorrow to catch up. And week 4 will be coming out as well. So look for that on the website. Tonight, we're going to continue to use Inside Out to talk about how to tell the gospel story. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at identity. And identity is an important feature of personhood, especially in our time today. And I think we have real opportunities to engage people on this issue of identity or the self. And so, starting off with, I want to talk about the challenge of this feature of the new social imaginary. Remember, when I'm talking about social imagination, I'm talking about how people kind of spontaneously view themselves, often because of the narratives they've imbibed and they've inherited because that's what they hear every day. They've within the culture that they find themselves in. And one of the feature that I want to talk about in relation to identity is this idea that you have to be true to yourself. And to do this, I want to use what's called Sheilaism. There's a book called Habits of the Heart, where there's a really well-known book called Habits of the Heart by a sociologist, Robert Bella. And he actually has a team who's doing this research and talking to Americans about what they believe, what they value. And there was this interesting interview he had with this one woman named Sheila. And Sheila was a young nurse, and she said that she had actually has her own religion that she calls Sheilaism. And he said, Bella said, she ended up being kind of a picture of a representative picture, or her story was representative of so many of the conversations he had. And this is what Sheila said. She said, "I believe in God, but I'm not a religious fanatic. I can't remember the last time I went to church. My faith has carried me a long way. It's Sheilaism, just my own little voice." And I just would add, this is my wording here, Sheila's faith has some tenets beyond belief in God. They're not many. In other words, she says, yes, I believe in God, and you know, but she says, you know, basically what it comes down to is just try to love yourself and be gentle with yourself. You know, I guess take care of each other. I think God would want us to take care of each other. And Sheilaism is, on one hand, it's different than the kind of some of the other secular narratives we've been looking at. It Sheilaism believes there's some kind of belief in God here, but it's clearly distinct from Christianity. This is not there is no God, but this is rather there is no God kind of out there beyond me that I must submit to, but rather this is a God that purely kind of is somehow mystically inside of me in a way that's different from Christianity and different from really traditional religions. Traditional religion said, okay, there's a God who's outside of us, who has created the world, and there's a fabric to the world that he's created, and I must submit to it. But this is a God that's really is really going to be found kind of in this still small voice without any kind of outside standard. And so it's about looking within yourself, finding this still small voice, and then living a kind of flourishing life according to whatever you hear. This fits really nicely. Shigalism fits really nicely within a highly individualistic society, within a pluralistic society where people want to say, hey, you do your thing, you do your thing, I'll do my thing. So an individualistic society, a pluralistic society, and a morally therapeutic society where really feeling better about myself is the ultimate end. And so tied to Shilaism is this notion that Bella calls expressive individualism. And this is the idea that each person, and you'll hear parts of Shilaism in here, each person has a unique core feeling and intuition that should unfold or be expressed if individuality is to be realized. Each person, in other words, is to throw off the shackles of expectations. You be you, and don't let anyone from the outside or anything from the outside impose something on you. You have to be true to yourself. Now, I want to add that this also fits well within the kind of, you know, I'm talking about this kind of mystical, therapeutic kind of spirituality that has gained a lot of traction in our culture and will be present when you talk to people. But it's also true in the kind of optimistic secular narratives where there is no God, and so you make the rules and you just listen to your heart. And so it fits with people who say, yeah, there's a God, and also fits with people who say there is no God, and so we get to make our own meaning. And tied with this is a kind of self-authorizing morality. What I mean by that is it holds personal choice up as the highest good. And so it's kind of this moral system is an extension of expressive individualism. In other words, you know, me making a personal choice is the highest good, and you making a personal choice, whatever that personal choice is the highest good. So as long as your personal choice isn't infringing on my personal choice, that's our ethical code. And that's important to say here at the beginning when we're thinking about where are we at culturally when we talk about identity. Because again, we're talking about identity and people are saying, hey, to really flourish, we need to have an identity. Where do you get your identity from? You look inside yourself. You find the true you, and then you live that out. And then what's the true you? Well, the true you is, you know, the greatest sin is to deny the true you, not to deny some kind of moral code out there. The greatest sin would be to deny the true you rather than to deny God's kind of ethical code for us. And this is captured, I talk about this, in the book, and this is, it hit me as I was writing the book, because I also saw this Jeep commercial as I was thinking about expressive individualism. And I think this captures these three points. There is a Jeep commercial for this new kind of Jeep called the Renegade. And in the commercial, they had young female music stars, and they were coming on the screen, and they all had the kind of these short axioms by which they lived. And one of them said, I have chosen to be unapologetically me. A renegade is someone who doesn't seek the approval of others. In other words, don't seek the approval of any group. You just be you. A renegade sets their own standard. You see the moral aspect of that. No, you set your own standard. Now, the issue here is if you stop to think about this for a second, we should all wonder how purchasing a mass marketed Jeep and being persuaded to do so in a commercial could ever constitute being unique. It's a mass marketed Jeep. Or, or in any way being persuaded by a commercial that therefore is unapologetically me. But I think, so on one hand, there's this kind of, if you reflect on it, it's a pretty ridiculous kind of appeal. And yet I think it's an appeal because they recognize it's something with the kind of ethos of our day that would be attractive, especially to young people. But I think it reaches far beyond young people who have taken this kind of approach to life. But even as I challenge that commercial and I am going to be challenging, of course, this kind of idea, I think it's deeply embedded in the late modern psyche. And I think probably if we're honest, all of us have inherited this kind of individualism to some degree that we need to reflect on. But I also want to say at this point, not so fast. Let's not get ahead of ourselves either. I think there's something here we need to say, okay, there's a problem, but we miss an opportunity. And a lot of what I'm doing in these next few weeks is I want to model for you how to think about conversations. This isn't, don't think of this as, now this is what you say then, or this is what you say here. As I'm just scripting out your conversations, but I'm trying to model for you a way to think about conversations. And I think that there's something to challenge, yes, but there's also an opportunity, because it's not simply narcissism here. I think we live in a narcissistic culture, so that is present, but it's not simply narcissism. Everyone who's logged in this class has had the freedom to make decisions in very important areas of their life, such as, I'm assuming anyway, whom to marry and what occupation to pursue. We know that these types of freedoms it's not always been the case. And in some ways, what I want to suggest is this kind of extreme individualism, what I'm calling expressive individualism, is a correction going too far. In other words, in past societies, there has been an over-hierarchical structure that generally made social advancement a hopeless endeavor for the poor. And it was a very impressive, oppressive environment where many people, including women and minorities, lacked a kind of social status, freedoms and liberties that we take for granted today. And this too often led to degradation of the individual. In other words, so when I'm pushing back against expressive individualism, I don't want to say, and I don't think we need to be careful that we're not nostalgically looking at the past saying, oh, if we could only return to back then when everything was hierarchical and, you know, the peasants were kept in line. Okay, that's not the approach we want to take, and we want to be careful with that. But we also want to say, I think that what's happened is an overreaction to that. So, you know, the kind of democratic liberalism that we live in, I think we can value and appreciate while recognizing that we have kind of morphed a type of freedom into something that has gone wrong. It's kind of an ethos of freedom that has gone wrong. It's not a freedom for something greater than freedom, but freedom becomes an end to itself. And that causes lots of problems. And so what I'm doing here is, and what I want you guys to understand is a kind of subversive fulfillment. In other words, I'm saying, you know, there's something right about your individualism. There's something that's actually, that you're getting at that's really important, but there's also something with where we're at when we rejected God and said, no, it's just me and kind of what I decide. That's actually not going to deliver on the promises it's making. And let me give you three areas here that I think you can look for to talk about in conversations with this kind of attitude. One problem here is it's unstable. In other words, if you base your identity solely on internal feelings, it's what I feel, you look inside of yourself, be the true you, then the problem here is that desires and feelings often change, and we know this from day to day, from year to year. And so if the true you is always in flux, this is going to be an extremely unstable roller coaster ride of a life, because your identity is always in flux. You don't have a core identity because it's simply based on how you feel. The second part of this, even though people are struggling to make this work, it's ultimately, in the end, impossible to simply look inside yourselves to define your true identity. We cannot help but act according to the expectations and opinions of those around us. In other words, you know, when people rebel and, you know, the Jeep commercial, it's like, be a renegade and drive a Jeep, which millions of other people are driving. In other words, we're always looking outside of ourselves. So even though this creates an unstable environment because we're told we should be looking inside of ourselves, at the same time, it's ultimately a dead end, because we're just going to be shifting between these different groups and trying to win their approval. So it's ultimately impossible. And third, it undermines, and this is where we're going to spend most of our time tonight, it actually undermines some of our deepest existential needs. So this type of deep individualism actually cuts us off from our deepest aspirations as humans and our basic existential needs. And so what I want to do is talk about four of these in the next few minutes. And here's what I see is, again, four opportunities. There are opportunities for us to get in a conversation and talk about these areas. And the first one I'm taking is taking this idea of identity head on. The next three, I'm not sure if we'll get to all three, but the next three are kind of coming in through the side door, so to speak. They're related to identity because it's related to morality. It's related to being loved, one's love, you know, being loved, and finding a love that truly sets us free. It's about pursuing justice. But all of these things are actually tied into identity, especially in the kind of late modern expressions of them, and we'll talk about that. So again, we're using this paradigm that I've set up, which is we're going to step inside their story, ask questions, get in a conversation, and then ask them, hey, what about this? Try on the Christian story. So let's start off with identity. Nearly all people at some point in their lives find themselves searching for a kind of self-worth. I mean, this is what we do as humans. If we're honest, you know, we, as I've already said, we don't simply look inside of ourselves. We can't help in some sense to look outside, to look at culture, to those around of us for affirmation. We seek affirmation that in some sense we're valuable and we're worthy and we're good people. And so everyone looks to other people and to see what's important, to find our identity, to find what we should be pursuing for happiness. And we all have someone, some group, or something we consider the ultimate authority, at least in a practical sense. In other words, the person you're talking to might deny that there's a God, but in a practical sense, they're still turning to something as what's most important, what's the ultimate authority, what am I going to live for? And what they're going to do is they're in some sense going to trust that thing. They're going to say, this is that person's opinion is what matters the most. And they're going to base decisions on that. That thing matters the most. And they're going to base their decision on that. And so what I'm getting at is our identity is rooted in what we pay homage to. And that doesn't have to be something particularly, at least how we think about religious things. In other words, we validate ourselves in the eyes for others. We're on this quest, as one author puts, for cosmic validation. And eventually we're going to sell out to something. We're going to sell out to something. That's what we do as humans. I think heard me mention the author David Foster Wallace, who wasn't a Christian and wasn't particularly religious. But one of the things he says in this famous speech he gave a few years before he committed suicide, is he said, "Whatever you sell out to in this world, it will eat you alive. If you sell out to success," I'm paraphrasing him here, "if you sell out to success, you will always fear failure." Think about that. If success is the most important success in a certain way people have defined success, then you will always feel fear not living up to that, disappointing whatever their vision of success is. If you sell out to receive the love of others, you will live a fragile existence, constantly striving to secure affection. Some of us know this in our, from our relationship with our parents, when it never seemed like enough. And so you're always selling out, striving to get affection. If you sell out to your career, you'll end up bitter and lonely. And so we all source our identity in someone or something. That's what we do as humans. Yet in life, the people or things in which we source our identity in are constantly threatened or taken from us. I mean, any of those things I've mentioned things are going well, we know the prospect of them being taken away. And if they're challenged, then we feel the angst of that. And in essence, what we're doing is we're deifying something. We're basing our self, and people base their self on something. And if that thing is taken away, they feel robbed of their true self, of their very identity. So when this happens, they feel faceless and nameless and insignificant. And so Wallace, who again, not a Christian, but he knows something about this kind of existential reality, he explains it like this. He says, for all humans, he's saying, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. And so here's Wallace, the non-Christian, not a very religious man, who's saying, listen, we're all selling out. We're all worshiping. And he's saying, and of course I agree with him, that we feel the effects of worshiping things that leave us empty. And I would argue that that's because we were not made to worship those things. And notice here, as I'm borrowing Wallace, he's not a Christian author, I'm doing that intentionally because that often will have more authority to the person I'm talking to than, it's like, hey, let me tell you about David Foster Wallace rather than let me tell you about my favorite pastor or preacher. It's going to have more authority as I'm talking to them. And notice, though, even as I did that, how I'm using language like identity and selling out and validation. None of those are particularly religious. Those don't feel so religious. And I think it's okay. I think I would suggest sometimes starting there because it's language they can relate to, and it's kind of within their normal language that doesn't feel overtly religious to them right off the bat. I think certainly there's nothing wrong with using religious language. It's just something to think about, especially with somebody who might be kind of taken aback if you start throwing out, let me tell you about justification or something along these lines, which just feels kind of very religious and in their face. So we have these problems when you seek identity based on these scripts, on this individual scripts. And so what I want to suggest to people is they actually try on the Christian story. Imagine how the Christian story might map onto their life and their story. In the same way that, pain warns us when we put our hand on the stove that I better pull it off, I want to tell people in that same way, what if God has so ordered the world so that when we feel empty, when we feel this anxiousness, when we feel this loneliness, when we feel this despair, it's a way of God saying, hey, something's not right. Hey, take a look at how you're living here. Something has gone wrong and we need to pull our hand away from the stove. We need to stop finding our identity, trying to find our identity here and actually seek another way, a more ancient way to go about finding identity that's stable and that can weather the kind of the winds and the storms of life. I'm going to argue that that's the Christian story. That it's actually Christianity that gives us a story about how we can know and live in a right relationship to the one who provides us a stable identity. When you're actually restored to God, when you're made right with God, when you become this friend of God, we're free to live in a right relationship with the rest of the world. So what actually happens is when God becomes the ultimate source of your identity and he says, and now you see yourself as a friend of God, a son of God, a child of God, who's been adopted by the Father, then what it actually allows you to do is it allows you to love the world, to love, you know, your job and love all of and relationships and love other people, but to really enjoy them because you're not making those things ultimate. So we were designed to ultimately love God, but then when we put these other good things up as God, it ends up ruining those things because they can't handle the weight and the pressure of being ultimate because they are, well, temporary. They're all movable while God is immovable. And so God provides us these promises that we will inherit a world to come. He gives us this stable identity that those promises are hooked to. And it actually allows us to really enjoy the good things that we're trying to put ultimate weight on. So that's one way. Of course, you can develop that out. If you read the book, I develop that out further. And I want to just stop now. I've started with identity. I have three more to cover. I've given an opening. I just want to stop. And if we can, I want to try this week, because I think we're kind of at a point in the class where we're starting off with just some kind of messages in, and that was good. But I think we're at a number now that if we can try just to, I'm going to stop sharing for just a moment and go to galley screen. And Sherry, can you kind of make it so everyone's unmute or can unmute themselves?
Ask people to unmute themselves.
Yeah, if everyone can unmute themselves now, and I'm gonna see if I can pull it up and we can see everybody. And if you don't want everyone to see you, can just turn your screen off. That's fine too.
Josh, this is Dave, and I can't see anybody but two people.
Okay.
I think Cotty and Katie are the only people I can see on the.
Okay.
We're in black
video.
We're unmuted. We're.
Okay. I know this is risky for us, so.
Camera is black. It's black.
That's unmuted.
I've introduced chaos into.
What is this?
You cannot start your video because the host has stopped it. Oh.
Okay. Can you guys see me?
Yeah.
I don't know where my picture is.
Okay, let me just see if there's any questions. And if you want to just speak up and kind of lean in. And or if you want to use the chat function, use the chat function.
Okay, so I have a question, Josh.
Yeah. Can you? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so
suppose someone does seek significance from their career or something of that sort. Have you had great success in getting them to see that this is not going to be fulfilling in the long term? I mean, have you really converted people to Christianity like this?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, so like I'll give you an example with my, I mentioned my neighbor here that he actually came to church with us on Sunday. And one of the conversations we were having was about, you know, career not being ultimate. He's a PA and works a lot. And I mean, it was something that he accepted pretty quick that, yeah, there's got to be more. And so then we were able to move into kind of morality, but also recognizing, I think that the thing here is for him, it's like recognizing how we do that. And then it doesn't work out so well. In other words, like, oh yeah, I'm over investing in work. And I think that the common kind of vice that people who hear is, well, kind of, yeah, you've got to spread out your assets, so to speak. In other words, you've got to have work-life balance. But, you know, one of the things we talked about is, yeah, but at the end of that, then, you know, you're still going to go something and make something ultimate. Uh-huh. And those things are fragile. Again, you're building these webs of meaning and significance for your identity, and all of, even accumulatively, those things are still fragile. So, I mean, it's not as if it's one thing when I talk to people. It's normally like, you know, it's explaining it. And then it's like, yeah, you know, I see that. And I see how, you know, one way I do it sometimes is start off with society and say, you know, one of the things that we're experiencing right now is a loneliness crisis.
Uh-huh.
And we're full of anxiety. And what we're being told from a young age is if you have the right job, if you do this, then life will work out. And if you actually look at the stats, that's not playing out. And it's a little less like right at them, and they can more agree at a societal level. Like, yeah,
I see
that. And I say, you know, and so then say, you know, there's been times in my life where even as a Christian, I know that that's not ultimate and I live for that and it doesn't play out good. And again, that's kind of showing my own wounds there.
Uh-huh.
And it's not that one of these is kind of, I'm not suggesting that any of these are necessarily a silver bullet that mm-hmm. leads to that, although it can be. I mean, I think morality, the one I'm about to hit, is a huge one. But it's a way to get at conversations that I think are, people can feel the kind of fragility, not only in their own lives, but in the world at large. And yeah, I mean, I think people are, become a lot more open than kind of, rather than a traditional, hey, Jesus is the answer.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't really set up what is the answer to.
Yes. So I really like what you're saying. I tend to think that you would only approach this with somebody that you had already developed a relationship with. You're certainly not the kind that would walk down the beach and stop a stranger.
That's right. And so it's also about and that's why we kind of started off with saying, are we settling for shallow conversations with those in our
mm-hmm.
life?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some relationships that I personally have settled for that, but then there's others I haven't. So I'm continuing working to practice what I preach too, mm-hmm. but I think there's, it's for a lot of times it takes more time now, right? People don't feel like they're missing something in many cases, and so it's going to take a little bit more time and more intentionality mm-hmm. than kind of just randomly stopping people at the beach.
I really like what you said about the society approaching it from a social problem rather than this person's problem.
Yeah, I think starting off, that's one way to go about it. Of course, the danger there is you never kind of say, how about you?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I think you got to go there, but it's, you know, you can take steps to get there. And so talking about society, because if you say, man, things are a train wreck right now, you know, that's a pretty easy way to get in the conversation. And let's go for that. But can we, but people are happy to talk there. We do have to eventually kind of press and say, what do you think? And kind of get in more of our own life. And I think also sharing the, our own scars is a way to also do that. Yeah. Anybody else before we go to the next one? That's a great question. I've got some chats here, so let me look. Okay. Pros and so somebody said pros or cons of conversations one-on-one or in a group. Can you use a group setting to build? I think so. I mean, so one of the things that sometimes happens is you get a conversation. So I have a friend who talks about he's constantly trying to set up his non-Christian friends with his Christian friends. And what he's not talking about dating. He's talking about like, hey, I've got these non-Christian friends here. I've got these Christian friends here. Let's have them over. You know, like, and just thinking like, hey, let's watch a game together. But just thinking organically, these things can come up. Also, if you're talking to somebody, and then you know, you say, hey, I'm talking to this non-Christian. I'd really love for them to meet this other couple at Holy Trinity. And I'd just love to meet them. But I also recognize, okay, I'm thinking that, you know, this will be a good opportunity to connect them up. So I think, again, thinking like that and thinking strategically like that, in the midst of kind of the busyness of our lives, I think a lot of times we just are kind of, Lord, give me an opportunity today. And yet we're not thinking very carefully and often about how the Lord might want to use some preliminary things to get those conversations going. So I think in a group, it can work. I think also individually can work. It just depends. Let me answer one more. Yeah. I think there's just some comments like this kind of individualism, I think we can all relate to. And I think that's that, again, we're not trying to cast ourselves as somebody who's immune from these cultural assumptions. And yet, and again, that can be a way to say, listen, this is something I've struggled with too. And yet I know that it doesn't lead to a good place. And identifying it in your own life and say, this is how Christianity's helped me. It's not that I'm perfect here, but this is how Christianity's helped me as I'm working through what I see as the emptiness of this storyline that I so often get embedded in.
Just thinking right now, you know, when people's identity is on the line, and because it is fragile, because it's based on feelings, the reaction is often a lot of anger if you challenge that.
Yeah. Well, I think what's being challenged, though, I think there's a way, again, to say, you know, there's something good that you love your kids. And I think that's wonderful and important. I'm just using kids as an example here. But, you know, if you base your identity in your kids, I'm saying this not because I want to hurt you, but I'm saying this just because I've seen it, you know, if you base your identity on that, your life's going to be a roller coaster. It's ultimately going to be unstable. And ultimately it's going to be selfish. And you're going to end up hurting your kids because they can't bear the weight of kind of ultimate significance. And I could talk a lot about that kind of we could think through that, how that's the case. And so I think one of the things to reiterate here, certainly when you start talking about sin, and that's what we're talking about, people can get offended, but it's a way to talk about sin is what I'm suggesting that gets at the kind of, they already feel it. You know, if they're basing their identity on their kids, they already feel the push and pull of what you're talking about. And if you do it in a respectful way and they get upset, maybe that's okay. It's ultimately—
well, I can see that in terms of career, kids and things, but the big issues of today are gender identity.
Yeah.
And that's not so easy to find even a really gentle way to say, do you think that's, you know, is that working kind of thing?
Yeah. And that's a big one, right? That's a big one. And I've touched that on that in Apologetics at the Cross on how to deal with that. That's a huge one. And I think it is tied into expressive individualism. I just don't want to go there tonight.
That's fine.
Yeah. Let's keep going. This is great. And I appreciate, because I recognize I'm giving you guys, like, just hear me this. I know conversations don't work vis-a-vis a PowerPoint. Okay. Like, I have conversations with people. I know that's not how it works. But when you're teaching someone, I'm teaching you guys, I want you guys to get in a kind of habit of how to think. Because when I'm in a conversation or even when I'm preaching, there's a kind of, I have this mental framework where, okay, what story are people assuming and how do I challenge that? Where can I affirm that? Where can I point them to how the gospel story is a better story? So I'm giving you the framework. I know conversations are messy, okay? And, but the framework I think is really helpful to at least have a loose structure going into these types of things. So I'm going to go back to PowerPoint if I can. I know that was risky. And if you guys can, if just unmute for me while I go through at least a couple more points here. So the other thing tied to this is morality. And to be honest, I think this is just such a huge one. It's tied to justice as well. Because, well, a few years ago, several years ago, it was popular for Christian apologists and speakers to rail against a kind of relativism in our culture. And I personally see our culture, there's certainly certain forms of relativism built into expressive individualism because it's based on emotion. But at the same time, there's this tension here between really strong moral intuitions from their feelings. I mean, and so really strong stances on morality. And I think this is a real opportunity for us as Christians, and it's tied into identity as well. So with expressive individualism, with its drive to free people from external norms and expectations and help them arrive at their true self, it produces an ethics based on personal preferences. The morality is constructed around nothing but expressions of preference, expressions of attitude or feelings. In other words, you have this kind of moral, what we might call the moral intuition. And it's a very strong moral intuition. And on one hand, I think we need to affirm that we are moral beings. But I also think we need to challenge their story here. And there's a couple ways that I would suggest challenging their story. And one is that if you begin to ask questions and you say, okay, I affirm that, hey, you're clearly have strong moral convictions. Where do you get morality from? You know, for me as a Christian, you know, I'm a Christian. So I believe in God. I believe He has formed the universe in a certain way, that there's a transcendent moral code. He's revealed himself through scriptures, through the person of Jesus Christ. But where do you get this from? And I think that there's a couple of ways at this point that people will go. I mean, one way is, you know, once they say kind of, well, simply moral intuitions, I don't have this listed, because once they say moral intuitions, you say, well, what happens when people don't share the same moral intuitions? and clearly that's what's happening today. People don't share these moral intuitions. So a couple of things that people throw out at times is, well, morality is ultimately grounded in culture. Well, this is actually, it doesn't work when you think about it, because if you're saying, now, on one hand, I want to say that certainly culture shapes our morality. I'm not denying that. But we're talking about, does it actually ground morality? Is it wrong to say, actually, the Nazis were actually wrong? It's not, even though they had these beliefs culturally, it's actually, there was something morally wrong about what they were doing, or that women should have rights, even if some cultures still today say women shouldn't have the same rights as men. Are they actually wrong? Is that culture wrong? And if you're trying to ground morality simply in culture, it seems you can't say that, or exclusively in culture, you can't say that. And the problem with this is obvious for most people that any of you are going to talk to. For most all people, they're going to say this ultimately will not do. Because for most people I talk to, they say no. Has to be something else to ground it in. So the other popular attempt is to ground morality in science. And I need to go in a little bit more detail here to explain sometimes what's going on here, because there's a bit of a sleight of hand on how people are using the term morality. And again, you can I can follow up to answer questions on this, but morality as a word, right, can be used to mean the realm of right and wrong. And in this sense, it prescribes something. There's an obligation. And so, if murdering innocent people are wrong, then, that would be a kind of moral obligation, right? Or we are responsible to care for the most vulnerable in our society. You're saying that there's actually a moral obligation to do that. And for Christians, when we use the term morality, that's typically what we mean. For a lot of people in society, when they use the term morality, that's typically what they mean. But at times when people are saying science grounds morality, they're using the second or third terminology or the second kind of definition of morality, second or third definition. The second one here, morality is sometimes used to mean the social rules and practices of a given society at a purely descriptive level. In other words, you're just saying, hey, in this culture, that's immoral or moral. But it's purely functioning at a descriptive level. It's not saying that's really right or wrong. It's not an obligation. It's just saying this is how this culture understands right and wrong. It's merely a descriptive project. And for some people, morality, and this third one is normally where the sleight of hand happens, sometimes intentionally, sometimes probably unintentionally, but morality is used to mean something that is instrumental. And okay, what do I mean by instrumental? By instrumental, I mean, it's more like this, and with my daughter who plays soccer, Addison, I tell her, if she wants to score, she has to shoot. In other words, I'm assuming that a kind of goal in the game is to score. And I'm telling her if she wants to score, if she wants to go by the rules of the game, if she wants to do that and win, then she has to shoot. But what I haven't done is that doesn't give you a moral obligation to say, she can say, I don't really want to score. That's not really my thing. Well, I'm just telling her, if she wants to do that, this is how you do it. But I'm not giving a kind of morality that's a real morality that says, no, you have a moral obligation to score. Okay, I hope that makes sense to you. And the reason I'm giving you what can maybe feel a bit pedantic at this point in these definitions is because often there's a sleight of hand. When somebody says science gives us morality, what science doesn't give us is a moral obligation. It can describe societies. It can tell us, hey, if you want to do this, if you want to score, this is how you shoot. And so science can help us in these different ways. Science good, but it doesn't give us a moral obligation. It can tell us science can tell us what is about the world, but it can't tell us what ought to be. And yet what there seems to be amongst humans, this kind of something from the outside. There seems to be that we feel this force of morality that says, no, people, they're actually an obligation to live a certain way, to actually live moral lives. I'm not here suggesting that you know, all cultures exactly have the same moral code. That's not what I'm suggesting. But I'm suggesting that people seem to universally have this sense of obligation, that even if they deny that there's moral obligation, they expect other people to live with a sense of moral obligation, and they themselves do too. And this is important because this is, you know, this is something that is so universal amongst human beings. And so when we're thinking about this, I think the Christian story, and particularly you might say the belief in God, gives us is the simplest solution to this experience that we all have, that we sense this morality from somewhere else, this moral obligation, because there is actually a creator God who has made us this way and has made a moral code. And that we are to live for a certain end, and he's created us like this. And so this kind of self-authorizing morality, I think, pushes back that I've tied to, remember at the beginning, self-authorizing morality is tied into this kind of expressive individualism. I think that actually pulls against how we were created. So people still sense this obligation to something beyond themselves. And this is where the Christian story gives us a God who, yes, we are morally obligated to submit to. As image bearers, the Christian story says we're moral agents made to reflect his glory. And so we can't help but being these types of moral creatures. And so the Christian story gives us a framework for value and moral obligation and purpose. And at these points, we all intuitively sense these points, but the secular story actually fails to adequately explain them. Let me just say this. Justice, in many ways, I won't go through all of this for the sake of time, and I want us to make sure we're getting out on time, but justice in some ways functions in the same way. We have this hunger for justice, and oftentimes people you talk to haven't thought about the morality question, but then justice, again, we could start at a societal level to talk about justice and different conceptions of justice, but asking the questions of what grounds universal human dignity and our obligation to care for others. Right now, we're experiencing this kind of, I think, this deep desire for justice and equity for all types, for all people. And that we say, hey, we have an obligation to care for others. And as Christians, no matter who we're talking to, whether they're an atheist or agnostic, if they're saying those things, I want to affirm that. But then I want to ask the question, where do you actually ground this kind of idea of universal human dignity and the obligation to care for others? Because it is not a universal belief. It is not the normal belief of societies in human history. And so how do you ground that? What story makes sense of that? And then the other thing is, what motivates people to act justly with high moral standards? You know, it's one thing to say, I'm going to act this way as long as other people treat me like this, or I'm going to act like this for my tribe. But why would I act in a selfless way for people I don't know across the world that have no impact on me? And then if you watch the news for 5 minutes, it's easy to begin to lose hope. And if you're passionate for justice, if you're passionate for these things that I'm describing, it's very easy to say, hey, maybe we can do a little bit, but it just seems like it's never enough. It's never going to be enough. And according to the secular stories, it's never going to be enough. And then we die. And it doesn't really make a difference. But the Christian story says, hey, we have a grounding because we're all made in the image of God. We have obligation to care for others because we were called to do this as image bearers. And then Jesus Christ, who is the picture of true humanity, cared for people even as they were persecuting him. And God has loved us so that we might love other people. So we have this obligation to care for others. And we have this motivation to act justly. Because look at the grace that we have received and experienced. And then we find hope because even though we know that we're not going to get perfect justice now, that the Christian story actually provides hope that when we stand even in small ways for true justice, we are standing on with God who has promised to one day come and bring final justice. And so this deep longing we have for hope is actually finds a register within the Christian story. So again, in the book, I lay these out and I'm using quotes from secular authors as well. But it's trying to give a way to say, hey, we don't have to push against somebody. If a non-Christian, if we start talking about what's going on in society now, and they say, and it's clear they're passionate about justice, that's something to affirm. Even if we can have some different conceptions of justice, and we can get to that, and we can have that conversation. But rather than using that as an opportunity to go political, let me politically, you know, push back. I would suggest that our number one our allegiance is to Christ and his kingdom. And I don't think we should be absent from politics by any means, but our number one duty as Christians is to bear witness to the gospel. And so as these things come up and hopefully, I think there's an opportunity for us to say, hey, maybe there's some stuff we can affirm and let's talk about Jesus. And to be honest, I'd much rather talk about Jesus than our presidential candidates anyway. So I would just suggest maybe even the next 2 weeks when it inevitably will come up to see maybe if you can pull a polite Jesus juke and do something different and maybe even unpredictable. So I didn't get to love. I will post the notes on that. And certainly if you guys have emails, some of you have done this already, you've emailed me during the week. I'm happy. I love those. Please continue to send me notes and messages or questions you have. And also check out the recording from last week if you didn't see that. And also the book, again, I didn't get to the love part tonight, but the book outlines that. So thanks for joining us tonight. And I will look forward to having this conversation and going to week 5 next Monday. See you guys.